Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
Hi guys, it's Jill here, and this is the 8th episode of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. Today we have another great author interview. Adam recently interviewed Sunil Yapa, author of Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, and I have to say this was a fantastic interview. I had so much fun listening to it. Sunil talks about why he chose the 1999 World Trade Organization protests in Seattle as the backdrop for his novel and gives some context and history about those events. He also talks about his own personal experience and how those sort of get interwoven into the characters. And also about having to write the novel twice, which has to be a writer's worst nightmare when your manuscript goes missing. So I hope you guys all enjoyed this interview. We're hoping to offer more author interviews in the future. If you have any comments related to the podcast, please feel free to reach out and find us on social media. We're at Twitter at Overdrive Libs and Facebook at Overdrive for Libraries. You can also email us directly at feedback@overdrive.com. Those emails come to Adam and I personally, so we appreciate all the feedback we get. So enjoy the interview and happy reading.
Hi everyone, this is Adam from Team Overdrive, and I am joined here today by Sunil Yapa, the debut author of Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. Sunil, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm really happy to be on Overdrive.
Yeah, and so just for people who might not be familiar with your book, it is set to the backdrop of the 1999 World Trade Organization protests that were in Seattle, and it's something that I feel like I'm maybe a little bit younger, but this was going on when I was a child. I actually wasn't even aware. I had to go back and remind myself of what these issues were and why these people were protesting. So can you kind of give our listeners an idea of why you chose the WTO protests as the backdrop to your story?
Sure. The brief context is it's November 1999, or a month from the millennium, and the WTO was a large organization, 135 countries, sort of setting the rules for fair trade internationally. And they decided to have their millennial meetings in Seattle, which was a bit of a mistake because 60,000 people, by some estimates, showed up to protest it. And the police were completely overwhelmed. They had no idea that that was going to happen. And the protesters had shut down the meetings by, I think, noon of the first day. Mm-hmm. They were protesting things. They felt that the democracy was being sort of superseded by the WTO, which was able to make decisions penalizing countries for environmental laws or labor laws or anything they deemed an unfair trade restriction. But what interested me most about it was that these were protests where we saw people in the streets willing to be tear gassed and pepper sprayed, really for the rights of people in other countries, to expand the rights of a kid making shoes in Vietnam in a sweatshop. And I thought that that was a really amazing moment of compassion and empathy becoming a global thing. And what I remember of the protests from the TV coverage was just that there was a bunch of violent people in the streets breaking windows, and the cops got violent. And I thought, there's so much more to the story than a violent riot. And I'm much more interested in the human stories and the courage it took to that brought people out into the streets, but also the courage and sometimes the stakes of the police officers who are also in the streets that day.
Yeah, and what struck me as fascinating, talking about both the officers and the protesters, what struck me as fascinating is the way that in this book that is based around a massive protest full of both violent and nonviolent, you know, protests and interactions, you spend a great deal of time having the narrators discuss their inner conflict, sort of what's going on in their minds and what made them who they are. Can you just go into why you felt it was so important that the reader understand what each of these different points of views and what these narrators were going through in their mind, let alone what's happening on that day?
Sure, absolutely. One thing is that it seems like there's a lot of backstory, but that really, because the book takes place on one day, it's really just the rest of the story.
Sure.
But also, it was really important to me to show that we all have histories, and it's something that I think about in my own life quite a lot. Particularly in heated moments, I think that our histories come into play. So, you know, there's a very famous photo from the Seattle protest of a police officer in the heat of the moment making a very bad decision and firing a tear gas canister into a seated crowd from about 3 feet away,
yeah.
Which is very dangerous to do, to come out with extreme velocity. And I looked at that and thought, what could have brought this rather ordinary man? He's certainly not a monster, but in this moment, what brought him, an ordinary person, to such an inhumane moment? And so I wanted to unpack that and try to understand that too.
And so in making these different characters and giving us their backgrounds, you're able to create these really layered, multifaceted characters. And I feel like a lot of times I read a book and the majority of the characters feel very single-minded or singly motivated, I guess you could say. And it's tough for us because otherwise, I don't know, sometimes I think authors are just want to tell us, you know, this person is the hero because they feel more than just one thing and here's what their whole backstory is. But when you began writing the story, did you anticipate having multiple narrators, or was it one of those situations where you were writing about these different people and you realized that you had different perspectives and you could share multiple people's, you know, kind of points of view from this situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to say it's a weird answer. I think it's actually, it's both, because I have a weird brain. I've always, as a writer, written from multiple perspectives. Even when I was trying to write short stories as a beginning writer, and you only have 10 pages to get something done, I would still try to do 3 or 4 narrators.
Sure.
Which doesn't work, by the way. So I've always written like that. And it might be partly because I'm biracial, and because I've traveled, and I just always see both sides of an issue, and I see multiple sides to any story. I've never believed there's one single story to any event or any person. So I think it was sort of a coincidence that when I found this subject, I knew immediately the right way to tell it was through multiple narrators, because it was such a complex issue. And there's so everyone there that day, and the book is told from the perspective of 7 people. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. They really believe that. And yet they're in complete conflict with each other. And I think that, I think we're all like that. There's one character, the police chief, who at one point is, actually pepper spraying people right in the face. And as he does it, he's saying, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." And I think he means it. I think he really means it. So he's naturally a very conflicted person, and I think that that's also reflected in the event itself. There's many different ways to look at the event, and I wanted to try to explore that through the characters.
And one of those characters, one of those main characters who I was really fascinated by is Victor. He's one of the, you know, the youngest people that we meet, and yet he's lived this intense life. He's been all over the world. He's seen so many different things, so many different people in various forms of struggling situations. His travels seem to mirror yours a little bit from looking on your website. Would you say that you see yourself in Victor a little bit? And did you share some of his experiences growing up?
Yeah, I think so. I think on the surface, Victor is certainly the closest to my experience. And I lived in Seattle when I was 19. I have traveled the world, maybe not as much as Victor, I don't know. But yeah, some of my experiences are in there for sure, and I think that's inevitable. But I also think my experiences are scattered all in all of the characters. It's really impossible to write a book without filling the characters with your own emotional experiences. And one thing that's in there for sure is I was living in Guatemala when I was writing this book. And I remember visiting a friend who was living up in the mountains working with Mayan community. She was a painter, and she was doing some artwork with them. And we would take her dog for walks. And I remember at the end of a walk, we were sort of sitting and talking with a shop owner at the edge of town. And these little kids kept coming up and buying one candle each. And I asked the guy, "What's with the candles?" And he said, "No, I lose. There's not electricity." And I sort of registered it. I didn't know what it meant, but I didn't think about it, really. And another time we were coming back on a walk, and it was already dark. And I saw off in the fields, like, these little ships of light. And it was these, you know, one-room houses made out of salvaged wood mm-hmm. and tin roofs with one single candle glowing in it. And it just, wow, struck me so profoundly. And yeah. it wasn't a feeling of guilt. It wasn't a feeling of shame or even how materially rich we are living in the U.S. It was a feeling of we live almost on different planets. Mm-hmm. You know, that experience is so different, and I don't want to say either that I felt the need to fix that situation, or that I even understood that situation, or even that situation was entirely negative. It just was so different, mm-hmm. and I think that you know, there's a lot of stories like that. There's a lot of experiences like that, and yeah, they definitely are there in the book. It's one of the things that I'm trying to understand.
And speaking of all of these different situations and, you know, seeing yourself in various characters, one of the characters who I was really fascinated by was actually the delegate from Sri Lanka, whose name I don't want to even try because I feel like I will butcher it. But I know that your father is from Sri Lanka. Did you write that character with your father in mind, or is that another one of those things where you saw some of yourself in it more than perhaps someone else?
That's interesting. Well, first of all, that's fictional because Sri Lanka was actually a member of the WTO.
Sure.
Well, first of all, you're referring to Charlie Vikramsinghe, who's the financial minister from Sri Lanka, and he's been traveling the country traveling the world for 5 years, mm-hmm. collecting signatures in a hope to petition for entrance into the World Trade Organization, meaning that he can now sign free trade agreements and join the world economy,
right.
Thinking that will raise his people's fortunes. That's not actually true. Sri Lanka was a member of the WTO since 1994, and was the facts of that story were more based on Vietnam's attempt to enter into the WTO. But yes, Sri Lanka, I wanted to talk about some of the colonial experiences that the character had growing up and how that mirrored some of his attempt to gain access to the WTO. And so absolutely a lot of those stories and his history and his feelings are some of my father's feelings. Although my father is the exact opposite. My father is a Marxist professor of geography and has taught about poverty in the developing world for 40 years at Penn State. But some of his experiences growing up in Sri Lanka, for instance, Charlie says at one point he knew the geography of London better than he knew the geography of his hometown.
Right.
Because he had read only English books. And that's something that came straight from my dad.
Okay, so about this book, something that blew me away doing some research on you is not only did you write this fantastic book, you quite literally wrote it twice. Can you explain to our listeners what happened with your original manuscript?
Yeah, if you excuse me, I'm going to go cry for a month, and then I go come. Yeah, you know, I hopefully I'm the last person this will ever happen to. I lost the first draft of the manuscript, which I spent 2 years writing, and was 604 pages. I finished it in a little beach house in Chile. I didn't have an internet there, which I thought was great, and it was great because I got so much writing done.
Right,
but I didn't back up any of my great writing, my prolific writing. And so I had finished it in Chile, 604 pages. I came back to the U.S. I was working as a traveling salesman selling posters on college campuses. You know, the first two weeks of the semester we would show up and sell posters to college kids. And I was in Chicago. Someone broke into my hotel room and stole the laptop, and I hadn't backed it up. I hadn't printed it. I hadn't even emailed it to myself. So I lost the whole thing. Yeah. And it was devastating. It was my worst nightmare because I was also coming out of grad school and it was the first long project I had ever finished. And I think I didn't write for probably 4 or 5 months, which is actually, now that I look back on it, pretty quick.
Yeah, I
got over it pretty quickly, but I watched, you know, every game of the college basketball tournament. I got deep into my Netflix.
Well, of course.
I was just trying to avoid thinking about what had happened. And it started to bubble up in my brain again, the story. And I thought, oh my God, one, what is wrong with me? And two, I think I'm going to write this thing again. And I actually did. And I had very good notes and I set out to recreate what I had done in the first one. And I found it really boring. mm-hmm. to not the book itself, but that there wasn't any imagination in just sort of taking dictation from yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I actually got a chance to reimagine my novel and approach it from a different angle. That first book had, I think, about 60 characters.
Oh wow!
So talk about multiple narrators. And I don't know why it took me 4 years and 600 pages to figure this out, but I read fiction because I really care about a character and because I want to know what happened to them and because I'm very invested in whether their dreams can come true or not,
right.
and whether they make good decisions or not, and what's going to be the consequence of their action. And if you have 60 characters, it's very difficult to invest and care about each one of them. And so when I went back, I thought, who are the people I care most about in this book, and who is most interesting and conflicted and deep, and is really going to challenge me, and characters that I want to spend another 4 years with writing. And these seven were the ones that made the final cut.
Yeah, I will say I can think of exactly two authors who I have read who have had that many characters that I actually have cared about, and that's George R. R. Martin and J.K. Rowling. So I think cutting it down, I think you really nailed it with the seven that you use, but I just can't imagine the mental fortitude that you must have to be able to go through and do this a second time. I'm incredibly grateful that you did, because this book is fantastic,
yeah.
But I can't
so
imagine.
I think it might be that I just a lack of job skills, because what else am I going to do?
Well, I think something tells me that this is going to be the one that you stick with. It is fantastic. I can't wait to read, you know, what you have coming next, and hopefully the next book you'll write. Maybe we look into, like, you know, Google Docs or something that has a cloud-based situation.
Yeah, I have about 5 backups of them.
Fantastic. So I want to get a little bit back into the book and some of the topics that are in there. You know, one of the things, unfortunately, that's very prevalent in our country today is police violence. It's, you know, a topic of conversation every single day. Clearly, you wrote this book before the events like Ferguson and Tamir Rice here in Cleveland. Did you consider,
right.
while seeing all of those things on the news, did you ever consider going back in and doing any edits or changing the tone of your story with the way that these situations are going on right now?
I didn't really. I was very surprised. I started writing this book in 2009. And that's before Arab Spring, that's before Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. and that's before a lot of, as you said, the police violence and brutality and protests surrounding them in Ferguson and Baltimore, Cleveland and New York and all over the country. It was very surprising to me how relevant and timely the subject matter was, because here we have a young black teenager and you know, he's actually biracial.
Mm-hmm.
And his white father, who's a police chief. And that was, and he's also, you know, experiences a lot of violence in the book and is looking for a place, and they're trying to reconcile. And I think that the story was already there long before all this happened. And that's a little eerie. Kind of interesting as a novelist for that to happen. And it's also, I have to say, a little sad to me that it's so relevant and that it continues to be so relevant. You know, I, in some ways, I wish it wasn't.
I completely agree. Given that Overdrive is a library company, we work with, you know, libraries every single day. Something I love to ask everyone that I'm able to interview is, do you have a favorite or a first memory of going to a library when you were a child?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my God. I feel like every writer has, you know, a story about the librarian they first knew, or, a first grade teacher that first introduced them to reading.
Sure.
Because, for me at least, we're all readers first before we become writers. So for me, that person was actually my mom. And I remember her taking me to the library with the Sklo Public Library in St. College, Pennsylvania, twice a week, because I read so much.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a person who, to this day, says, I feel rich when I have books.
Mm-hmm.
And I panic when I don't have any books to read. And also, when I was a kid, we spent a year living in Holland, and we spent a year living in Thailand. And in Thailand in particular, and this was 1986, there wasn't much globalization. You know, I was there when the first McDonald's opened. So there wasn't much American culture, and I felt kind of lonely,
mm-hmm.
Despite going to an international school and having great friends. But my mom took me to, I believe it was the library at the U.S. Embassy is where she found the most English language books. And I remember it just so clearly as, you know, a refuge. I really think libraries were sort of my churches. Mm-hmm. It was a place where that was quiet and where I could go and contemplate. And just even as a kid, just felt so at home in libraries.
And so what were some of those authors and books that you read while you were growing up, whether it was stateside or traveling the world with your family?
I was reading so much. I can't remember any specific titles. I do remember later on, back in the States, reading a lot of genre books. So I love Stephen King. I loved Getting Scared. I mean, even I think I read his novel It when I was probably maybe 12 or 13, way too old to be sleeping in my parents' bedroom.
Oh my
gosh. In fact, that's what happened to me. I got so scared I went and slept in my parents', not in their bed, but on the floor next to them.
Oh, of course.
And wouldn't go down into the basement where my bedroom was. But so, Stephen King, Tom Clancy, I remember really loving Roald Dahl's stuff. You know, mm-hmm. Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar was one of my favorite books growing up. Things like that.
I'm just trying to let my mind settle on the fact that you had a bedroom in the basement and still read It. You are a braver man than I am.
Yeah, well, my dad read it after me, and he wouldn't go down in the basement anymore.
I feel like that might be a book that the parent might want to read first next time, but wow, good for you. Yeah, I still don't like reading that, I'll be honest.
Oh, man.
All right, so one of the things that we do on all of our episodes here is we give out book recommendations for our listeners. So I know that you've been very busy lately, but are there any books, aside from your own, of course, that you would recommend people as a must read, whether it's something you've read recently or just something that's one of your favorites that, you know, you will go back and reread? What are the books that you would recommend people take a look at?
There is a book that I was intimidated by, and it's a couple years old, but I was intimidated by it because it's 800 pages and it looks like a doorstop. But I think it is our modern day Ulysses. I think it's the American Ulysses, and I've read it 10 times. And that's Don DeLillo's Underworld.
Okay.
And it's really Michael Ondaatje has a blurb on it where he calls it an aria to the 20th century. You know, and it really is, I think, the American masterpiece. It's such a beautiful book. It's filled with characters. And the first line is, he speaks in your voice, American, and there's a shine in his eye that's halfway hopeful. And that just so perfectly captures the last 50 years of American history and the end of the 20th century. And it's about baseball, and it's about nuclear war, and it's about painting, and it's about New York City, and it's about so many things that are American. And I written beautifully. I really love that book. I would also say, I was published in 1998. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for something more current, I'm reading right now a friend's book, which is going to be published, or maybe just published, in fact, this probably yesterday, Alexander Chee's book, Queen of the Night,
okay,
which is an imagined story of an opera singer rising from the dust of the plains and ending up becoming sort of celebrated in Europe and her whole journey to become, you know, one of the most famous opera singers in the world. And I'm reading it right now, and it's just beautiful. It's fantastic.
Nice. Well, so the last question I want to ask you before I let you go here, it's the one thing that I like to ask all of our authors is, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Yeah, I think that what I was inspired by reading the book is, again, like I said, not the violence of the riot, but the compassion of the riot. I thought it was so moving that people would be willing to go out into the streets and fight for people's rights that were not their own and people that might be three continents away. So if there's anything that I think readers could take away from the book and that I get when I reread it, in fact, is that that through those seven characters, you get a sense of a shared humanity. That we might be on different sides of conflict, and in an election year, it seems even worse than ever in the U.S. that we're so divided. But the truth is that we have a lot in common, and I would hope people read this book and come away with the idea that empathy and sitting and trying to understand each other's stories and where the other person is coming from. Instead of having a knee-jerk reaction and saying you're wrong, but instead trying to sit and really understand each other, it's a very powerful thing, and that empathy is actually a radical act. and a very powerful tool for change.
I think that is incredibly well said. For our library partners, Sunil Yapa's book, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, is available in Marketplace for you to go and add to your collection. And for our readers who are listening in today, if you're not seeing it on your library's collection, absolutely recommend it. It is fantastic, and you will absolutely love this book. Sunil, thank you so much for taking some time and introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us all about this fascinating story.
That was absolutely my pleasure.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections in Marketplace.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.